Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
The monarchs are very mystical creatures, you know. They arrive here on the Day of the Dead, which we celebrate here in Mexico, and a lot of the indigenous people believe that it's the souls of their ancestors that are returning, you know. And it's very spiritual, basically, you know. If you've been to the monarchs overwintering site, it's a very special feeling, you know, to listen to their wings and to see the quantity of monarchs. And when they come off the clusters and they fly to rehydrate, it's extremely beautiful, you know.
Listening to the wings of a monarch butterfly. What a magical thought. Jose Luis Alvarez is co-founder of Forests for Monarchs, a butterfly protection project around the Monarch Butterfly Biosphere Reserve in the Highland Lakes area of Michoacán, Mexico. And when he talks about listening to monarch wings, Jose Luis means listening to this. To the ear alone, it sounds like a light breeze or a gentle waterfall. But imagine yourself in a brilliant orange and yellow waterfall made up of millions of monarch butterflies swirling all around you.
These forests where they're overwintering are extremely beautiful forests. You can imagine these trees are up at 10, 12,000 feet. You know, the monarchs overwinter at that height. So to begin with, the air is very thin. It's chilly, okay? In the winter, it's cold. And in the summer, it's very humid because it's raining. So there's a great smell to it. And there's a variety of tree that they prefer, which is the oyamel. And it's kind of like a United States fir tree. It's very, very beautiful. Then below that, you have the pines. And then after the pines, you start getting some oaks, and they're very thick, old forests, very beautiful, very, it's hard to describe. You'd have to come and see it. It's incredible. It's millions of butterflies, and they're migrating, and they're stopping in the same place on their way down. So, like, I'll give you an example. There'll be a school in Monterrey or in Matamoros. These are towns in Mexico. And outside of this school, there'll be a very beautiful tree. And each year, the monarchs will take a rest there. They'll stop and rest there overnight. And the children know that they're going to go to that particular tree. And this is year after year, the same tree, although they've never been there before. The numbers are lower now. When I started planting there 23 or 24 years ago, there was a greater quantity. You know, there was a terrible freeze in 2002. I was actually photographed during that storm, and I'm standing in the butterflies, and they go up to my knees, basically. One of the reasons that I've been doing this for 23 years is because there's space for it to be done, because many of these mountains that had forests many years ago, and I'm talking decades ago or even more, were turned into agricultural fields. And the slopes on them are terrible, you know, so the land is very eroded. And so I've changed a lot of agricultural sites or agricultural fields back into forests. I've been planting trees there and seeing them grow. You know, I have trees now that are 23 years old, so they're huge trees. Trees grow much quicker here than they do in the United States and Canada and in Europe. So in 15 years, actually, you've got huge forest. we have climate change, and you know, the forests are suffering from that. It rains less and there's more heat, so there'll always be, you know, some problems with this climate change, and we have to, you know, try to do something about it. But in general, if you think about this, if the monarchs have been doing this since the last ice age and they've adapted themselves, the survival of their species depends on this migration. So they're extremely clever. This may be a bad time, or the numbers may be low. They may be now considered an endangered species, but they're very hardy. They're very strong. If you could call them intelligent, I would call them extremely intelligent. And if they've survived this long, I'm sure they will continue. I'm sure the numbers will go back up if the forests are taken care of correctly. And if there's enough milkweed, I think it'll be fine.
Jose Luis Alvarez. He's co-founder of Forests for Monarchs and owner of the Vivero Forestal Nursery in Mexico. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And Jose Luis talked about the declining numbers of monarch butterflies. The decline has been heartbreaking. According to new estimates, the eastern monarch population has dropped by more than 80%. For the western monarch, it's worse, a population decline of 99.9% in the past 40 years. The International Union for Conservation of Nature is a global conservation group representing 1,400 government groups and NGOs around the world. It also consults with the UN on conservation and biodiversity. And just last month, the IUCN put the monarch butterfly on its red list of threatened species. The butterfly is endangered. But its fate is not yet sealed. The monarch butterfly can be saved. Well, joining us now is Chip Taylor. He's founder and director of Monarch Watch, a nonprofit that focuses on the monarch butterfly, its habitat, and fall migration. He's also professor emeritus at the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Kansas, and he's with us today from Lawrence, Kansas. Professor Taylor, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here today.
When did you first fall in love with the monarch butterfly?
It's hard to say. You know, probably when I was 7 or 8 years old. Raised them on and off for years and years and years. And then professionally in 1992, after the work that I had been doing with the so-called killer bees was coming to an end, I decided to look to monarchs because there was a lot of opportunities here to do some really interesting science.
And when you were that young boy, that 7 or 8 years old, I understand that your grandmother had a lot of land? Or how did you get outside so much and interact with the animals?
Well, I was kind of a nature boy. And I was a nature boy really because I spent 3 years in the three summers with my grandmother on an 80-acre piece of land up in northern Wisconsin in a place called Crivitz, Wisconsin. She had a river running through the property, and that river was just full of life. And she let me roam a lot. There were certain restrictions on where I couldn't go, but I really had an opportunity to explore. And as a kid who was really kind of interested in all those things that were under all those rocks in the river, oh, what a great opportunity that was. And of course, there were insects, all sorts of things that were fascinating, like Luna moths, for example, and many other amazing insects. So, yeah, that's where I got it started. It's really why I'm a biologist, because I had that experience. And that particular property was also a Native American camping ground way in the past for the northern forest Native Americans that were living there. And it was clear that this was a temporary site. And then there were all sorts of berries and food items that could be harvested in that particular area. So that fascinated me, really fascinated me. And I've kept in touch with kind of the Native American community, partly because of all of those experiences I had as a kid.
Mm. And I understand on your grandmother's property, there was a lot of milkweed. So you saw the monarchs.
Oh, yes. That's where I probably had my first experience. But, you know, specific memories like that are not there. But, you know, there are some very general memories of this being a very formative period in my life.
Yeah. So what is it about the monarch butterfly that's so captivating, you know, to you and just about everyone who's ever had a chance to see them, interact with them, even raise them, as you said?
You know, they're big, they're beautiful, they're slow, and they're accessible. By accessible, I mean you can find a caterpillar, you can bring it in, you can feed it a few leaves, it'll form a chrysalis or pupa, and 10 days later or so, it'll come out as a magnificent butterfly. And you can't do that with very many other things. This, you know, when I'm saying it's accessible, it means that you can handle it, you can see it. You know, most butterflies are too fast. Mm-hmm. Most butterflies are too fragile. This is a tough customer. This is a butterfly you can handle. It's got rubbery-like proteins in it that make it possible for this butterfly to migrate great distances.
Yeah. You know, I remember when I was, I think, in second grade, we did exactly what you said, right? We had some caterpillars, raised them, and, you know, that seeing the jade green chrysalis, right, with the little gold dots on it, I don't know, even just that stage of the monarch's life is so beautiful. It's something that you never forget as a child. But it must be harder to find the caterpillars these days, right?
It is. It is. And that's there's several reasons for that. There's less milkweed and there's less butterflies. And, you know, we've eliminated the habitats for these butterflies in so many regions where people actually live. So we have fewer and fewer people that have intimate contact with nature and intimate contact with monarch butterflies simply because the habitat has been eliminated where the people live. Mm. So we're trying to change that.
Well, so that's what we're going to talk about because we are taking a clear-eyed look at the fact that the monarch butterfly is now considered endangered by a major international conservation group. But we're also going to talk about the fact that it doesn't necessarily mean all hope is lost for the monarch. This is a story of good. There's a lot of things that people can do in their own backyards to help save this magnificent species. So we'll talk about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the monarch butterfly, recently named an endangered species by an international conservation group. We're talking about why that is and what we can do about it. And I'm joined today by Chip Taylor. He's founder and director of Monarch Watch and also professor emeritus at the University of Kansas. And Professor Taylor, before we talk about why there's a significant threat to the monarch's survival, I just still want to spend a few minutes talking about the general awesomeness of the monarch butterfly. So first of all, why is it called a monarch?
Because when the pioneers, the first colonists, came over from England, William of Orange was the king, and they called the butterfly King Billy when they first saw it because it was orange, and it was William, so it was William of Orange. Therefore, the butterfly became, King Billy, which then morphed into the monarch.
I see. Okay, so a regal name lineage there. Right. You know, a couple of springs ago, I raised some butterflies. with my kids, and they were painted ladies, though. And when the painted ladies came out, this is our first time doing it, I was like, wait, those look exactly like monarchs. So first of all, how would you tell the difference, and what exactly does a monarch look like?
Well, a monarch is a very large butterfly. It's among our very, among the largest of the butterflies. It's equal in size, for the most part, to most of the big swallowtail butterflies. The painted lady is probably a third of the wing area of a monarch butterfly.
I shouldn't have confused them at all.
Right. No, you should not have confused them. And the monarch is, you know, it doesn't move as fast as a painted lady does. A painted lady just zips around. I mean, it's a nice butterfly. I like it a lot. I've raised a lot of them, but it doesn't have the charisma that a monarch does.
Okay. And then so the monarch has what, these beautiful orange-yellow wings with sort of black stripes through them?
Yeah, it's basically a posematic coloration. It's advertising that it's distasteful or something that most things would not like to eat. And because this coloration is orange, black, and white is what it is, not yellow, is considered to be a warning sign by most insects and vertebrate predators that might eat something. So there's a whole guild of insects that have that sort of coloration. And they're all advertising that they really shouldn't be eaten. And this is the basis for a lot of mimicry complexes in butterflies in the tropics.
I see. Well, by the way, for folks listening, if you've got stories of interactions with monarch butterflies in your life or have noticed a change in the monarch population where you live, hop on social media, Facebook and Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. We'd love to hear from you. Okay, so Professor Taylor, ecologically speaking, the monarch should be found, what, all across the United States and in Mexico and Central America as well?
Yeah, yes. This is a butterfly that is widely distributed on a seasonal basis. It goes from Canada all the way to Peru.
Canada to Peru. Okay.
Right. And so, and there, you know, there's not just one migration. There are other migrations. There's a small migration in Peru, another small migration in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
So this isn't the only migratory population.
Got it. So we're going to talk about the migration in a second here, but just so that we do acknowledge this. In the ecosystems that the monarchs are found, I presume they're an important pollinator. What's the role that they play?
They really aren't an important pollinator.
Oh, okay.
This is a frequent misconception. They do pollinate, but they're really not designed to be a good pollinator. But they do carry pollen long distances, and that therefore they have some role in maintaining plant diversity by spreading the genes far and wide. But it's not an efficient system, and they shouldn't be regarded as a major pollinator.
Okay. You know what? Today I am going to school with you, Professor Taylor, because I think I had this misconception about them being this critical pollinator since the second grade. Okay. So everyone who made the same mistake as I did, you have learned it here on Point. Do not consider the monarchs an important pollinator, important being the key word here. So then what role would you say they play in the environment?
Well, that's an interesting question because everything has a role, and very often we don't understand all of those roles that organisms play. But almost everything is food for something else, right? So, you know, when we look at the demography of this butterfly, probably 98 or 99% of the eggs that are laid do not become adult butterflies. Something has eaten them along the way. So we have parasites, we have predators, we have pathogens that consume these immatures. And so the demography of this butterfly is such that they produce a lot of eggs with a very small success rate.
Okay. Food for something else. It's that great web of life.
But so that's right.
The migration, the big migration, where do the monarchs migrate to and when?
Well, the migration starts at Winnipeg at really probably at the end of this week, the first week of August. And that migration moves slowly and picks up more and more butterflies as it moves south. And then as it gets to the mid part of this country, that is mid-latitudes, the migration speeds up. It moves a little faster. And then as it gets into Mexico, it slows down again. And the net effect of all of this is that the butterflies are leaving the northern areas in Winnipeg at the same sun angle that they arrive at in Angangayo, where the butterflies are overwintering. So let's make this clear. Everything that has gone on in the past has told us that the butterflies arrive in Mexico in the last couple of days of October, just in time for the Day of the Dead, which is usually on the 2nd of November. Mm-hmm. So the butterflies arrive, the souls that Jose Luis was talking about, the souls of the children and the departed ones presumably come back. But they come back pretty much at the same time every year, at least the first do. Mm. And so the question has always been, how do you explain that? Well, we have explained it on the basis of our large tagging program, which shows that basically what the butterflies are doing is tracking the declining angle of the sun in the fall. And they're basically following this route. And when the sun reaches a point where it's, let us say, less than 50 degrees above the horizon at noon, which we call the sun angle at noon, then the butterflies stop in Mexico. But that's when they start in Winnipeg.
Oh, fascinating. So,
yeah. There's a celestial clock here that basically determines the basis for the migration. That's not to say that the migration isn't influenced by all sorts of weather conditions. And it is. I mean, if it gets really, really warm, and it is getting warmer in the fall, then the migration is slowed down. And what we know from the tagging data that we've done is that there are lots of problems with monarchs that are in migrations that are delayed. If the migration is delayed, fewer monarchs reach the overwintering sites.
I see.
So when we talk about climate change, we ought to be talking about the specific impacts of those changes on the behavior of the butterflies. And one of the things that concerns me about all of the discussion about whether monarchs are endangered or not is that, you know, fundamentally, we just don't know enough about this butterfly to call it endangered. Mm. We really don't. I mean, we don't know the demography very well. We don't know the physiology very well. We barely understand some of the important aspects of the behavior. And we're still, you know, we're really at the beginning stages of trying to figure out how this butterfly responds to all the environmental variables and how it responds to the predators, parasites, pathogens, and so on in the system. So, you know, I've had an interesting reaction to this sort of thing about calling the butterfly endangered. In the long term, yes, in the long term, you could say this is endangered, but this is really the precautionary principle writ large, in the sense that we know that there are major serious threats to the butterfly in the future, but there are no identifiable threats that are of this magnitude, a sufficient magnitude right now to declare this butterfly endangered. I mean, that's my take on it. Yes, in the long run, this butterfly should become endangered. It will become endangered. But in the short run right now, I don't see the justification for that, because the population really hasn't changed in the last 10 years. So
help me understand why the IUCN, when it announced that they were putting the monarch on their red list, said that specifically, for example, I read that fact from that conservation group about the 99.9% decline in the Western monarch population.
Yeah, let's take a look at that. They have a counting system where they count the butterflies that go to overwintering sites along the California coast, and they got down to something like 1,900 or 1,800 butterflies in 2020. And then, you know, you look at that, and that's below the extinction threshold. That butterfly population should have absolutely crashed. And then last fall, which is not considered in their decision, we had 246,000 butterflies come back to these areas where there were only 1,900 the year before. 246,000, that was the eighth largest population that they've ever measured. Uh-huh. So that tells you a lot about the fact that we don't know how this population functions. You know, if you can go from 1,900 to 246,000, you're missing something really big time. You're missing something about how this butterfly functions. And this is, you know, for me, seeing all of that says, You know, if you look back at the history of this population, it had to be really low in the past. You go to the dirty 30s, there had to be far fewer monarchs at the end of the dirty 30s, which was 8 years of extremely high temperatures and dust-covered plants and mm-hmm. what have you. And you know, but butterfly had to be really low and at the end of the 30s. It was 8 years of really a devastating climate. So this butterfly is very resilient. It has a capability of bouncing back. The thing that really worries me, though, is habitat loss. Mm-hmm. Habitat loss is continuing. We're losing maybe 2 million acres a year to habitat loss. There's about 1 million acres of grassland and marginal lands a year are being lost due to one aspect of land conversion or another. And then we're losing maybe another million or more acres to development. And that means that unless we are restoring that much habitat per year, we're running as fast as we can and we're not getting anywhere. I mean, we really have to begin restoring more than 2 million acres a year to kind of keep pace with what's happening in the country, because human beings are changing the environment on a constant basis.
Yeah.
And we need to adjust to that.
Well, so this is actually the perfect moment for me to bring in Wendy Caldwell. She joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota, and she's executive director of the Monarch Joint Venture, a nonprofit that builds national partnerships of federal and state agencies, nonprofits, and other groups to conserve monarch butterflies. Wendy, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So actually, we just heard Professor Taylor give us what I think is, first of all, a reality check. And within that reality check, it's good news, right? I mean, it's quite something to hear the fact that the monarchs do have historically quite a volatile population level, right? It can seem to precipitously rise and precipitously decline. So would you agree with him that, you know, the fate of the monarch is not necessarily sealed just yet, and perhaps we shouldn't even call it fully endangered?
The fate's not sealed just yet, but I think one of the factors playing into today that Chip often talks a lot about, and I'm surprised that he didn't, is that monarchs need these well-timed resources. So as we start to experience these effects of climate change with drought and wildfires and severe winter storms, monarchs can recover, can pull back from these desperately low populations. But if something happened in that time when they were really vulnerable and really low, that could just be completely destroy the population. And so those are the kinds of things we think about as well, of yes, with good conditions, monarchs can recover, and with conservation efforts, they can, but they're also experiencing more frequent and more severe conditions, climate conditions, climate factors.
Okay, so tell me more about what those climate factors are that have a particularly negative impact on the monarchs.
I named a few. So, you know, think about that migration mm-hmm. north. And so monarchs are following the milkweed north, the habitat that's growing. So here in Minnesota in the spring, the milkweed doesn't come up until May, typically, and then monarchs arrive shortly thereafter. But in any part of that journey north, if monarchs aren't timed with the milkweed, if it's a cold spring or a wet spring, you know, and the monarchs aren't timed with the milkweed, then their reproductive potential changes. And so that timing is important. In the fall, when they're migrating south, they need not just nectar resources, but an abundance of nectar resources to fuel that journey. And in Mexico, for example, we've seen these severe winter storms that, with the right combination of cold and wet, can kill millions and millions of butterflies in one short time frame.
Mm-hmm. Professor Taylor, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think Wendy's identified what I'm really concerned about in one respect. And this is why I said that, you know, in terms of the long-term threat, monarchs are endangered because of those winter storms in part. So if we go into a winter with a very low number of butterflies, and then it's that area is hit by one of those winter storms and we lose 70, 80% of the population, it's going to be years before monarchs can recover. So And if you ended up with a big winter kill and then you had an extremely warm March like we did in 2012, or we had a drought like we had in 2011, or even 2000, we had a severe drought, you know, any combination of two or three events in a row that are negative would take this population down. There's no doubt about that. It's just impossible to predict those circumstances. We've had big winter kills in 2002, 2004, 2010, and 2016. We're due for another one. And so that's really concerning. Yeah. And in terms of what is causing those storms, this is new. This is all new. We've never had a storm that would kill 80 or 90% of the butterflies in the past. But this is due to the heating of the Pacific Ocean.
I see.
And the heating of the Pacific Ocean is driving massive air masses, which have contained a lot of moisture, toward the Americas.
Well, so you're talking about long-term climate trajectories then that don't really bode well for any of us, but including the monarch butterfly. But so when we come back, we're going to really talk about the fact that there's a lot that we can do, even in the face of that long-term climate trajectory, to help the monarch. So that will be what we discuss in just a minute. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're talking about the monarch butterfly, whose population numbers have dropped precipitously over the past many years, leading one international conservation group to put the monarch on its red list of endangered species. But we're hearing from a couple of monarch experts today about the fact that the butterfly's fate is not yet sealed by any means, and there are things that we can do to help it. I'm joined today by Chip Taylor. He's founder and director of Monarch Watch and a professor emeritus at the University of Kansas. And Wendy Caldwell joins us as well. She's executive director of the Monarch Joint Venture in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I just for a quick second want to go back to the monarch's migration, Professor Taylor, if I may, because I'm just in awe of it. And we kind of skipped over some important things. First of all, the monarch is the only butterfly known to make this long two-way migration every year. Is that right?
Yes. The key word is two-way.
Yeah.
Right? They go to Mexico. They overwinter for four and a half, maybe even 5 months, and then they migrate north again in the spring. That is distinctive. There's only one other insect that makes a two-way migration, and that's a moth in Australia. But it doesn't have the charisma that the monarch does, and it doesn't go as far as the monarch does. So the monarch, the migration really stands out.
It does. And, I mean, we're talking about an insect that's, what, a gram or so?
No.
Less?
A half a gram.
Half a gram. And sometimes it can travel more than, what, 100 miles a day?
Rarely.
Okay.
But so here's something to consider that's pretty interesting. Right now, this year, in the Maritime Provinces of Canada, which is way, way, way in the northeast, there's a good population of monarchs. And they are going to start migrating in a few days. And they have about almost 3,000-mile trip. It'll take them two and a half months to get to the overwintering sites. And they have a very arduous journey. A lot of them come down the East Coast and don't do well. Some of them come across mid-continent and then get to the Texas-Mexico border and eventually get there. But the numbers that make it are infinitesimally small relative to, say, the butterflies that would come out of Minnesota where Wendy is. They have a much, much better chance of getting to Mexico because their route is more direct and it's half as long.
Got it. So, Wendy, we've got to help your Minnesota monarchs there. But there's one more thing about the migration that just kind of blows my mind. And that is each migration takes a full generation of monarchs, right? So every new monarch that's born has never done the migration before, right? And so
that's correct.
How does it know where to go?
It doesn't. That's the really interesting thing. It doesn't know where to go. It has no cognizance. It has no memory. It has no genetic engineering in its mind, in its genes to tell it where to go. What it does have is the ability to respond to physical conditions in a way that has it pretty much tracking a series of environmental cues that have the effect of getting it to where it needs to go. But believe me, a lot of monarchs don't make it.
Yeah.
This is not a perfect system. Wow. So there is magnetic orientation involved. There is physiographic orientation involved where they're involved, orienting to structures and things of that sort. There's a lot of ability to sense humidity because they need to have access to plants and water and so on and so forth. So it's a very complex system for an insect which has a very tiny, tiny, tiny brain. So this is what really makes it fascinating for many, many biologists. You know, how is this all genetically coded? How is this processed? How is the information that is taken in by the sensory system processed and converted into an orientation so the butterflies fly at a specific angle to the continent, to the magnetic field that allows it to get to where it needs to go?
Amazing. And in case I wasn't clear before, I just want to be clear that a monarch will do the migration once in its life and then die, right? And then the next generation does the migration again and then dies, meaning that there's no other monarch, there's no older monarch around to teach the little ones or the newly hatched ones or metamorphosed ones where to go, right?
Yeah, actually there are three generations or four generations between migrations.
Migrations, okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's not just two generations. It's usually three or four. And that's, that's even more bizarre, right?
It's amazing. So, okay.
Yeah, it's amazing.
We could do a whole hour just on how that works.
Oh,
but
I could take you all to butterfly school.
Sign me up. Okay. But Wendy, so we're getting a lot of comments here coming in because people love the monarch butterfly. For example, just quickly, Mary Kay Kushner in Iowa is saying she's been raising monarchs for the past 2 years and would love to know if it's a good practice or not. It brings her such joy, but I wonder, is this an important way to help get the monarchs off the endangered species list, just raising them as Mary Kay is doing, Wendy?
A lot of people like to raise monarchs, and it has that captivating characteristic. People just love to watch it, and it's a great educational tool. But in the end, we want monarchs to survive on their own, and the best way to help them accomplish that is to get more habitat, these milkweed host plants and native wildflowers across the landscape. That's the first and foremost the thing that we can do to help them continue to be resilient and survive and thrive on their own. So as an educational tool to get people inspired to help, absolutely, but not as a overarching conservation strategy.
Mm. Well, so milkweed, right, being a central solution in how to help the monarch butterfly. So let's listen to how that's working in the backyard of one woman in particular. This is Martha Askins. She's a retired lawyer in Madison, Wisconsin, where she's been planting native species in her home garden. And since her retirement, Martha started planting milkweed in her backyard for the monarchs.
Since I've been doing the Monarch Project, I have increased those plants that I know the monarchs require, and those are the milkweed. So now I have common milkweed, I have world milkweed, butterfly weed, and swamp milkweed all in my garden right now. And just before talking with you today, you know, I was watching a monarch sort of go from plant to plant and look for a place to lay eggs, hopefully. So it's really an interest in making my little corner of the world more hospitable to plants, birds, pollinators, what have you. At different times of the summer, the colors are different. In the spring, there's lots of purple, and then it goes more orange and yellow as the yellow flowers like Coreopsis and the Rudbeckia start to bloom. Right now, things are kind of at their peak. And so there's lots of purple with the blazing star, and there's purple, pale purple cone flower. There's the kind of musty green of the common milkweed. There's the bright orange and yellow of the butterfly weed. Most of the year, I have my bird feeder up in the middle of that, and the goldfinches at this time of year really enjoy the garden because they come down and take seed out of the cone flowers. It's great to see the goldfinches sort of perched on top of the plants, and they kind of sway in the wind. It's great. Hummingbirds come by. So it always feels alive to me. There's a lot happening in a small area. And yeah, I love it. When looking at milkweed for signs of monarch eggs or monarch larvae, it's a very meditative thing to take a plant that has maybe 10 leaves on it and look physically underneath each leaf. And then look, if I see a larva, it's the happiness that comes out of that is kind of surprising to me, you know, that seeing this little bug or this little, you know, caterpillar is like, yay, I found one, and I hope that this caterpillar grows to be a monarch. You know, the other things that I love about this garden, I think people appreciate it in the neighborhood. Sometimes, you know, I have some chairs out and I sit there and people say they appreciate it. I've had bird watchers, you know, say how grateful they are for it. It's really nice. And I like how it changes. I like how it's a little bit different every year. It's a little bit different every season. And to get those just kind of little moments of joy out of it is important to me.
Martha Askins in Madison, Wisconsin. Martha, thank you for letting us sit virtually with you in your burgeoning backyard. Now, Wendy Caldwell, I'm seeing the USDA calls common milkweed nature's mega food market for insects, because so many insects thrive where there is more milkweed. Is it a hard plant to grow?
Depends on the area of the country that you're in. Okay. It can be challenging in certain locations, in the Western landscape, in the South Central region of the United States. People can have a more challenging time growing these milkweed host plants. I mean, keep in mind that there are 100 species of native milkweeds across North America. Every state, give or take, has a dozen or so. Here in the Midwest, we have common milkweed, which is what you're referring mm-hmm. to, and it's widespread across a lot of the United States. And this plant in particular is pretty well adapted to disturbance. It loves cultivating and it loves mowing, and so it thrives in those sort of disturbed environments. And so in some cases, we always encourage people to plant milkweeds in their gardens and common milkweed. But if you're going for that more contained garden look, there are other species of milkweed available that might be a little bit less less aggressive compared to common milkweed.
Okay. There's other forms of milkweed that people are asking questions about. For example, one listener says, is it harmful to plant tropical milkweed? The listener's in mid-Missouri. Because they're wondering if it encourages the monarchs to breed too late in the summer. Is that true or false, Wendy?
Tropical milkweed is not native to the U.S. I hear Chip laughing here.
So grow it, period.
So, you know, it presents a lot of challenges and a lot that we have more to explore. But we definitely encourage that planting of native milkweeds, tropical milkweed, especially if grown in areas like Southern California or along the Gulf Coast, where the winter freeze doesn't cause the milkweed plants to die back. It can have some interactions with migrating monarchs and diseases. And so we haven't talked a lot about this protozoan parasite that's naturally occurring in the population, but it gets complicated really quickly when we start to add these complicating factors to an already really complicated system.
Yeah. Oh, so I appreciate you saying that, because Professor Taylor, let me turn back to you. Look, there is definitely a part of me that wants to get swept away with the idea that if everyone who had access to a patch of land was able to put in some more native milkweed, and that this would be the thing that would make the difference in the monarch's long-term survival. But you had also talked earlier about the rate of habitat loss that's going on. So do you think that, you know, people individually planting more milkweed would make a difference?
Well, we've got to do something, don't we? And so, in 2004, I received an email from a farmer in Nebraska who said, you know, I'm using these new crop lines that are resistant to glyphosate or Roundup at that point, and I'm eliminating the milkweeds that grow in those crops, and I'm seeing fewer and fewer monarchs on my property. And I said, oh my goodness, you know, this is the future. We're going to lose all of that milkweed that's out there in the cropland. And we did. By 2006, there was virtually no common milkweed growing in corn and soybeans and many of the areas peripheral to those fields, simply because of the use of these herbicides in conjunction with that crop protection. So I started a program called the Monarch Way Station Program in 2005, and right now we have over 40,000 registered sites across the country. We even have Monarch Way Stations in 8 other countries, because it's a field of dreams concept. You create it and they will come. What we need, however, is not 40,000 monarch way stations in this country. We need 4 million monarch way stations. I mean, we need them everywhere. I mean, we have big areas, big fractions of the country which have no native milkweed because we occupy the space. Mm-hmm. We need to change that. I mean, this is a migratory insect. You can say, you know, as a migratory insect, it has to have resources across this whole landscape. If you have big areas where there are no gas stations, there are no grocery stores, you don't get to the distance that you need to get to replicate successfully. So, yeah, we do need to restore habitat in a lot of different ways. In 2010, we created another program, which we call the Bring Back the Monarchs program, which is basically a habitat restoration program. And we've distributed over 1 million milkweed plugs. These are small 3 to 4 month old milkweed plants for those restoration programs. And that effort is largely underwritten by corporations and foundations. If we had the money, we could probably do 1 million plants a year, not 1 million plants in a decade.
Wow. So you could increase the rate of the planting by a factor of 10. So there's another reason to continue the effort. And it's not that often that we come up with moments where really individuals can make a big difference. So I want to say thank you so much to you, Professor Taylor, Chip Taylor, Professor Emeritus at the University of Kansas, for joining us. Thank you so much, Professor Taylor.
You're welcome.
And Wendy Caldwell, Executive Director of Monarch Joint Venture in Minnesota. Wendy, thank you as well.
Thanks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.